Okay, now we just finished talking about genetic engineering, and one of the results that comes out of that is that eukaryotic cells have introns, and we explained a little bit about how those are removed. And what I want to do actually next is talk some more about eukaryotic cells. We've said most of the things we want to say about prokaryotes, and now I want to talk about eukaryotes, how one cell makes two. We already discussed for a prokaryote how you double the DNA and divide the cell in half and apportion the two copies of the chromosome. But now I want to talk about how a eukaryotic cell doubles its DNA and apportions it equally into its two daughter cells. And when we finish how one eukaryotic cell makes two, then we're going to consider how, if you have a multicellular organism, how you get offspring. But for now, we're going to stick to single cells. So since we've already talked so extensively about prokaryotes, we want to compare the setup in a eukaryotic cell to a prokaryotic cell. What are the differences in structure that are going to require some complications when it comes to division? So if we were to compare the two cells, prokaryotic cells are much smaller. Eukaryotic cells are much bigger. I don't have the exact scale right, but this was discussed earlier in the class and is discussed in your textbooks. Now, the difference in size is reflected in the amount of genetic material. Eukaryotic cells have much more genetic material. So if we said sort of the size of the genetic material, it's really very different. In E. coli, it's in the order of 3 million base pairs. And in eukaryotes, it's much more. And this becomes clearer when we consider about how the genetic information is rearranged. In the case of prokaryotes, what is the number of chromosomes or the number of pieces of genetic information? And we said that in bacteria and prokaryotes, it's usually one. There is one circular chromosome. So there is not only one, but if you consider the shape, it's circular. But in eukaryotes, there is so much DNA that it's subdivided into individual pieces or chromosomes. So I'm just going to write many. And each individual chromosome is usually not circular, but linear. And we've already indicated that replicating DNA is a little different. If you have circular or linear DNA, you don't have to worry about the end problem in telomeres if you have circular DNA, but you have to worry about it if you have linear DNA. So now if we come back to the size of the genetic material, the total in E. coli is about 3 million base pairs. Now, eukaryotes generally have multiple chromosomes, and each chromosome is usually longer than the entire E. coli chromosome. So the average eukaryotic chromosome is usually 2 to 5 base pairs per chromosome. And then remember, of course, 2.5 times 10 to the 7. Which means this is at least 10 times as large. So you have 10 times as much per chromosome, and then maybe 10 or 20 chromosomes, you've got a lot more DNA. Now, where is that DNA in the cell? In the case of eukaryotes, you probably all know that eukaryotes have a separate compartment bounded by a membrane called the nucleus. And that all the genetic material, all the DNA, is actually in the nucleus. So the DNA is here. But in bacteria, the DNA is not in a separate compartment surrounded by a membrane. It is in one area of the cell. It is localized, but it's not surrounded by a membrane. So if we ask, is there a separate compartment for the DNA? In bacteria, no. And higher organisms, yes. Now, this has consequences. Remember, we were talking about the removal of introns. If there's a nucleus, this is restricted to eukaryotes. In eukaryotes, you make the RNA using the DNA template inside the nucleus, and then you remove the introns inside the nucleus. So you can finish processing the RNA, and only when it's ready do you send it to the cytoplasm where the ribosomes are. So transcription takes place in one compartment in the nucleus, and translation takes place in a different compartment in the cytoplasm. Now, this is not true for prokaryotes. In prokaryotes, as soon as the RNA is made, ribosomes attach to it and start translating it. There is only one compartment. Everything takes place in that compartment. So there is no place to sequester your RNA until you have processed it. And that's one of the arguments about why you can't have introns in prokaryotes, because you couldn't get the introns out before the ribosomes got there. Now, of course, when you consider the issue of duplication, having a nucleus makes for complications, because not only do you have to double the DNA and divide it into two cells, but each cell has to have a nucleus. Now, there are two other factors here. What is the DNA attached to? In prokaryotes, there's only one DNA molecule, and it's attached to the membrane of the cell. So by growth of the membrane, you can segregate or separate the two copies of the DNA. So if we ask, is it attached? And what I'm writing here is equivalent to a table in your notes in the same order, so if you don't get it exactly down, you have a table in your notes. So the chromosomes, the DNA, is attached to something in prokaryotes, but it's not attached to anything in eukaryotes. Now, as we will see during division, it is attached to something, but not the rest of the time. Now, there's one more issue here, which is the state of the DNA. In prokaryotes, the DNA is not associated with a specific class of proteins. But in eukaryotes, the DNA, which is very long, is folded up with a special class of proteins. And these proteins are called histones. Now, we won't talk about the details of histones till next term, but you should be aware that the DNA of eukaryotes is not naked, so to speak, but associated at all times with histones, which means that if you're going to double the DNA, you have to double the histones. If you're going to read the DNA, you have to somehow separate the two so you can get at the DNA, etc., etc. So, how are you going to get all the DNA and the histones doubled in time and divided properly between the two daughter cells? That's the question. And the answer to that is that eukaryotes have what I call the two-state solution. There are two different states of the DNA. One is specialized for doubling the cell in size, doubling the DNA, making RNA, etc. One is sort of the synthetic make it phase, and the other is the distribution phase. So, if you look at cells in those two phases, they actually look different. If you look at a cell that is not dividing, that is between divisions, and is said to be an interphase, you see a nuclear membrane, and you do not see individual chromosomes. Instead, the genetic material looks sort of like this. In other words, it's all just sort of tangled up. Now remember, this DNA is associated with proteins, but the combination is all sort of stretched out and tangled up, and this strait is called chromatin. At this point, the state of the DNA is relatively loose. The DNA is stretched out enough so that it can be replicated and transcribed. Enzymes can get to it and use it as a template. But now when it comes down to division, This is the distribution phase. The DNA has been doubled, and so have the associated histones. And now it's time to divide up the duplicated DNA so that each daughter cell gets a complete set. And in order to do this properly, each chromosome then has to be coiled up relatively tightly. So you have to disentangle the chromosomes, the individual pieces, and each piece is wound up relatively tight. And you get a picture that looks something like this. Exactly what it looks like depends on what stage of the operation you're at. So each of these is an individual chromosome. And at this point, notice that the nuclear membrane is not visible, because the nuclear membrane is temporarily disassembled and pushed aside. You can't see it. So if you look at the nuclear membrane, yes, no, can't see it. And the DNA is now relatively tight. In fact, people use the term condensed. Now, the DNA is in a double helix, it's double-stranded, it's in a double helix, it's associated with histones all the time. The difference is it supercoiled or super coiled? Is it, how much is it folded back on itself? And it's folded back on itself many orders of magnitude during division, so you can see the individual rods. Now, in order to get this kind of structure, each individual chromosome is pulled to one part of the cell. And so there's a set of fibers in the cell, which are known as spindle fibers. And the individual chromosomes are here. Notice that a chromosome can look like a V, it can look like a V, it can look like a J, it can look like a rod. It depends on the stage of division and where the spindle fiber is attached. We'll talk about that more later. So now if we put in, is there a spindle? The answer is no. Yes. Now, as we will see, both the nuclear membrane and the spindle fibers are made of materials that are there all the time. But the question is, how do you arrange those materials and what do you use them for? Okay. Now, the only other thing we should mention is, we said it already, but let's just put it on our table. Can you use the DNA as template? Can you transcribe or replicate it? In the chromatin state, yes. In the chromosome state, no. So there's no transcription or replication during division. All that is done during the chromatin phase. Now, you can see, looking at this, that things look much more interesting during division. You see individual chromosomes, and if you watch during division, they move around. This seems very interesting. Interphase, when a cell is not dividing, looks very blah. Looks like nothing is happening. It's not interesting. That's why they called it interphase, in between the interesting phases. But in fact, all the interesting synthesis stuff, all the DNA replication and transcription, is taking place here in the chromatin stage. So it looks dull, but you can say that's where really almost all the synthetic action is. Now I want to look a little more closely, first at interphase, and then at the parts of it, and then we'll look more closely at division. So first let's look at interphase. Or in fact, let's look at the whole shebang. Yeah. One way of thinking about what a cell goes through in its life is defined as the cell cycle. Now, the idea here is you have division and you have interphase. And the kind of division we're talking about is called mitosis. As we will explain. And so this section of the cell cycle is called M. And the rest of it is interphase, or I. So what happens? A cell divides in M. So you have a small cell here, and it gets bigger and bigger as it goes around the cycle, until by the end of interphase, it's double size. Doubled its DNA, doubled its protein, doubled its RNA. And now, during mitosis, all that stuff is divided or split up into two smaller cells. And then the two smaller cells do it again. So that's why it's called a cycle, because the cell just goes around and around. Now, the way I've drawn it here, there's only two parts to it. There's mitosis or division, and there's interphase. We know we can subdivide mitosis into phases, and we'll get to that. But can we subdivide interphase in any interesting way? We have discovered that you can, and that in fact, DNA replication is restricted to a period in the middle of interphase. So in this part of interphase, approximately, all the DNA replication takes place. So this is called S for DNA synthesis. Transcription and translation occur at other times, but synthesis of DNA replication occurs only during this part. I'm not sure I said that right. Transcription and translation occur during the other parts, but only replication is only during S. So that means that there's a period when the cell is gearing up and not making DNA yet. And that's called G1, for gap 1, the period from the end of M to the beginning of S. And then after DNA is finished replicating, the cell doesn't divide right away. The cell does some other things, makes some other proteins, etc., which it takes to be ready in order to divide. And that period after DNA replication finishes, but before mitosis, is called G2 or gap 2. The gap refers to there's a gap in DNA synthesis. Now, how do we know about this? How do we figure out that DNA replication doesn't occur in G1 or G2? The way this was figured out was by supplying radioactive T, actually tritiated T. Radioactive T was added to cells. Now, if you add radioactive T to cells, what do they make it into? T. RNA? DNA. Protein? No. The only macromolecule you can make out of T is DNA. So you can ask, if I feed radioactive T to a cell in G1, does it make any radioactive macromolecules? The answer is no. If I feed radioactive T in G2, I don't get any radioactive macromolecules. Ditto for M. But if I have cells in S and I feed them radioactive T, they will make radioactive macromolecules, which are, of course, DNA. So the only time radioactive T is incorporated into macromolecules, i.e. DNA, is during S. So if you follow cells as they go around the cycle, you see that no DNA replication, DNA replication, no DNA replication division. What if I fed them radioactive U? When would it be incorporated into macromolecules? M, G1, S, or G2? So I would like you to think about that one for just a minute. Check with your neighbor to see if you agree, and then maybe we'll take a vote. So for each of these periods, if you provide radioactive U, when will it get incorporated into macromolecules? M, G1, S, or G2? So before I take a vote, let me ask, are there any questions about this? Okay, so let's, yeah?
Can translation and transcription occur in S or no?
Can translation and transcription occur in S? Yes, they can. The part of the DNA that is actually this mint with... The question is, if you have, first of all the DNA doesn't replicate at the same time. So the DNA that isn't replicating can be transcribed, etc. Second of all, though, we think that probably sections of the DNA can be both replicated and transcribed at approximately the same time. Exactly how that works is not clear, but it seems to be true. Okay. So the first question was, if that's all true, can you make, will you incorporate RNA during S? How many say yes? No? Okay, we all agree. What about G1? Can you incorporate U? Yes? No? Why not? Doesn't sound right?
No, because you're not making... I thought transcription or translation would be happening during the S phase.
Her question was, she thought transcription and translation would be happening here.
Well, I know replication is, but I thought what you just said is that translation and transcription...
Transcription and transcription can occur at the same time, but you can have one without the other. You can have DNA that is being transcribed when it's not being replicated and vice versa. The real question is the DNA here stretched out enough to be used as template? And the answer is yes. When is the DNA not available to be template? Only during M. So when can you not incorporate U? G2? M? M is the only time you cannot incorporate U. You cannot transcribe the DNA because it's too tight. But in G1, S, or G2, you can transcribe, or you can transcribe the RNA, the DNA to make RNA. Now, most protein synthesis is supposed to thought to happen in interphase, but there may be a little bit in M. Okay. So what we're saying then is that all of the DNA is replicated during the S period. In order for this to happen, since the DNA is so long, that each individual chromosome or DNA molecule has to have multiple origins of replication, all of which are bidirectional. We're not going to go into the details, but just to say that because the DNA is so long, to get it done in time, you have to have multiple origins of replication per molecule. Well, remember, with bacteria, generally, you only have one origin on a single molecule. So suppose all the DNA is replicated, all the DNA is doubled, all the proteins more or less are doubled, and now you want to divide all that stuff in half. Well, before we can discuss how that works, we have to take a little closer look at what is meant by a chromosome. If you actually look at the chromosomes at the beginning of the cell cycle, let's say here, could I look at the chromosomes here? Remember, what cell looks like that? The chromosomes during interphase are all stretched out and you can't see them. The only time you can see individual chromosomes is in M, during mitosis. So when a cell has just divided, before it gets a chance to stretch out its chromosomes, the chromosomes look something like this. But before the cell divides, when the chromosomes all tighten up and coil or condense and they're all ready to divide, the chromosomes usually look something like this. Now, what do those things represent? In order to understand that, I think you want to look now at 19B. Start with a chromosome that just looks like a rod. We know that each chromosome contains one double-stranded DNA molecule. So that's why we've said this equals a structure, really. Inside is one double-stranded DNA molecule. Now, actually, that DNA molecule is extremely long. It doesn't go linearly from one end to the other. It is wrapped around with protein and folded upon itself many, many times. But if I were to pull one end of it and stretch it out, it would be one long double-stranded DNA molecule. But now what happens when I replicate the DNA? I have semi-conservative replication, so my two strands come apart and each one makes a partner. How are these two molecules related to each other? They should be exactly the same. Now, each one has an old Watson, the other has an old Crick, but in terms of information content and base sequence, they should be exactly the same. And what we're going to want to happen is one daughter cell is going to get one of them, and one daughter cell is going to get the other copy. So to keep straight that these two are copies of the same thing, they remain connected. So a chromosome before DNA replication, a single chromosome, so to speak, looks like this. But a doubled chromosome looks like the picture above. Now, when we say single and double, do we mean single-stranded DNA and double DNA? Double-stranded DNA? No, we do not. We mean one double-stranded DNA molecule versus two double-stranded DNA molecules. So what we have here on the left is a chromosome, and what we have on the right is a chromosome. But they're clearly quite different. One has one DNA molecule in it, and one has two. So in the middle here, this is what happens at S. This is the structure that's usually drawn as an X. Now, depending on where the connection point is, either the X looks like that, or the X can look like uneven, or the connection point can even be at the end, in which case the chromosome looks like a V. So the chromosome can look like a V, like an X or an uneven X, depending on where the connection point is. And the point where the two halves are connected is called the centromere. And the term centromere is used to refer to the region of the chromosome where the connecting part is, and to the connecting part itself. The connecting part itself is made of protein, but it always forms at the same spot on any particular chromosome because there's a special DNA sequence at that part of the chromosome. So, depending on exactly your terminology, either just the connecting protein or the whole thing is called the centromere. Now, we have here then either a chromosome with one double-stranded DNA molecule or a chromosome with two. And to keep it straight, the structure with one double-stranded DNA molecule in it is called a chromatid. So another way to say this is that a chromosome can have only one chromatid. That's before DNA replication. After DNA replication, each chromosome has two chromatids. As long as the two chromatids are connected at the centromere, you're considered to have one chromosome and not two. Now, this chromosome has two potential chromosomes in it, but for now it's only one chromosome with two chromatids. Now, a single chromosome does have a centromeric region, which you could probably see in pictures as an indentation, which is where the connections will form. But for the moment, there's only one chromatid and nothing for it to stick to. When the chromosomes are attached to spindle fibers, the spindle fibers attach to the centromeric region of the chromosome. So they get pulled by this section. we go back to our picture here, what we're saying is that when you get to the end of G2 and the cell is ready to divide, each chromosome has two chromatids. Now, each chromosome has two chromatids here also. But why can't I tell that?
They don't wrap up.
They're not wrapped up. They're not condensed. They're all stretched out. And so whether there's one or two, I can't tell. But at the time when you get ready for M, the chromosomes actually condense and are visible. And you can see that there are two chromatids per chromosome at the beginning of M and one chromatid per chromosome at the end of M. Now, whether a chromosome is X-shaped or V-shaped depends on the position of the centromere. So having said that now, we want to switch from looking at the parts, subparts of interphase and ask, what happens in mitosis? You can divide mitosis up into phases, which are called prophase, metaphase, etc. So what are those? So that's on 19A. So we're going to look at mitosis today. We're not going to get to the detailed steps of meiosis below it probably until next time. So you want to keep this for reference and bring it back next time. But let's look through the stages of mitosis. Well, any kind of cell division has to be preceded by an interphase in which the DNA is doubled. Because unless we have two chromatids per chromosome, we can't do division. So we have an interphase here in which the DNA is replicated, but you can't see anything. So that's what's happening. The important part in here is that the DNA and the histones are being doubled. So we double the chromosomes. Okay. Now, you can actually see that a cell is starting to divide when you start to be able to see chromosomes and the nuclear membrane starts to be taken apart. So you see something that looks like this, and you see chromosomes, but they still might be a little bit long because they may not be fully condensed yet. This is called prophase. This is the first stage of mitosis. Now, as we've indicated before, the nuclear membrane parts are not lost or degraded. What happens is that the proteins and lipids that make up the nuclear membrane come apart into pieces, and those pieces are shoved aside for the time being. So it's a little like you have a Lego castle, and you take it apart into Legos. You don't burn it, you don't throw it in the trash, but you take it apart into Legos or to smaller pieces. And then when we're all done, we'll take those Legos again and put them back, except we'll make two smaller castles. We'll make two smaller nuclear membranes instead of one big one. So the parts are being shuffled aside. And the chromosomes are starting to condense. Now, it's pretty obvious from looking at this picture that the DNA has already doubled and that there are two chromatids per chromosome. But if you actually look in a microscope under certain conditions, you won't notice this because, let's draw our chromosome again. We've drawn our chromosome doubled like that. Here's one set of sister chromatids. And here's the other set of sister chromatids. So this is one sister chromatid and the other sister chromatid. So the double-stranded DNA molecule in each half. However, sister chromatids tend to stick together. So this structure tends to look like this in many pictures. Sometimes you can see a slight indentation in it. The two sister chromatids tend to stick together. And so sometimes at this point, you can't tell that the chromosomes are doubled just by looking, because they look sort of like this. They're thicker, but they don't look doubled. And this confused many people in the beginning. people at first were not sure when the DNA doubled because the chromosomes didn't look double in prophase. But we now know for sure from these labeling experiments and from other things that the DNA was doubled back here in interphase, even though you may not notice it until later. Now what happens? Now, what is the point of mitosis? The idea is you had one cell, it doubles in size, you divide everything up, and you get two identical cells. So from that point of view, what is each daughter cell going to get? Is it going to get one or the other of these? No way. It's going to get one white chromatid and one pink chromatid in each daughter cell. So if we're going to line everything up so it can be divided in half, you have to think about how you're going to line it up. Now let's say all the chromosomes in the next phase line up on a single plane. This stage is called metaphase. And the plane on which the cells line up is called the metaphase plate. Now it could be anywhere. It could be here, could be here, could be here. But I'm going to make it through the equator for the purposes of this picture. Remember, this is a three-dimensional cell, and we're assuming there's a plane through the equator. So all the chromosomes line up on this plane, so that for each chromosome, one chromatid can be pulled to one pole, and the other chromatid of the same chromosome can be pulled to the other pole. Now, if this cell here only has two chromosomes, but if this were a human cell, it would have 46. And all 46 chromosomes would be spread out on this plate. But we're going to draw just our two. So they're going to be something like this. And what's going to happen is things are going to be moved this way. Now, how did the chromosomes get to the middle? They were attached to the spindle. So spindle fibers formed, and they were attached to structures at the poles and to the chromosomes near the centromere. And the pulling of the fibers is what aligns all of the chromosomes on the metaphase plate. Now, just as the nuclear membrane was taken apart and pushed aside, the same thing happens with, actually, spindle fibers. Spindle fibers also have two states, one during division and one during interphase. It turns out that these fibers are rearranged during interphase to do a different job. So this is also like Legos, but if the nuclear membrane is made of Legos, this is made of something else. Tinker Toys, whatever, Lincoln Logs. So these pieces also can be rearranged to do more than one function. They're always rearranged to make fibers, but what those fibers are attached to, what they pull around, and what they're used for varies depending on where in the cell cycle you are. So during division, the spindle fibers are used to move the chromosomes. Now, we're not going to talk about how this works at all now. We'll talk a little bit about it next semester. If you're interested in the details, it's covered in Becker in gruesome detail. And if you take cell biology, you learn all about it. So we've largely left the spindle fibers off this picture because we're not so interested in what moves the chromosomes as where the genetic material goes. We're not so interested how it gets there, but where does it end up? So the next stage is called anaphase. And now remember, we're going to end up with two sets of genetic information, and each set is going to have one white and one pink. So the way this is done is by separating the two halves of the centromere. Now, if the centromere split and the spindle fibers continue to pull, what will happen? So this chromosome on the left here will separate into two individual pink chromatids, which is now each a chromosome, and each one will be pulled by its fiber near the centromere toward a pole. So what happens is they're pulled like this. Now, on your picture, they're not drawn as V's exactly, but more like J's. Now, that would happen if the chromosome had its centromere not exactly in the middle, but close to one end. So if we split the centromere and then we pull, the chromosome is then going to look like that, like J-shaped. So whether it looks like a J or a V or a rod depends on where the spindle fiber is attached, at the end, exactly in the middle, near one end. So we're going to draw it this way. Now, this is anaphase. And because we put the metaphase plate in the middle of the cell and push the chromosomes during the pole to the poles, the way this cell is going to divide into two is it's going to pinch in the middle. If I had put the metaphase plate this way, then the cell would pinch through the longitude, but now it's going to be through the equator. So this cell in the next stage starts to pinch in half. Exactly how it divides in half, how the cytoplasm divides, depends on whether this is an animal cell or a plant cell. But you start to put, in any case, you start to put the nuclear membrane back, and the chromosomes start to stretch out. This is sort of the reverse of prophase, and this is called telophase. And then the job is finished off. We're going to finish dividing the cell in half, reconstituting the membrane, finish putting the nuclear membrane back, finish stretching out the chromosomes, and now we have those two smaller cells, each with a complete set of genetic information, but now the DNA is all stretched out in the chromatin form. Okay. How does the genetic information in this cell compared to the genetic information in this cell? It's going to be exactly the same, except if this cell is before S, it has one copy of everything, and so does that. If this cell is after S, it has two copies of everything, and that has one. But the total amount of information is exactly the same. So if a cell divides by mitosis, and then these cells divide by mitosis until you get a lot of cells, all those cells constitute a clone. All those cells are genetically identical, bearing mutation. Now, can you learn anything from looking at cells in mitosis? And the answer is you can learn a great deal, and I want to consider that for a minute. And a lot of this is diagrammed on 19B on the top. You may remember that at metaphase, all of the chromosomes are aligned in one plane. In addition, they're maximally condensed or shortened and the easiest to see. So if you trap cells in metaphase, which you can do with drugs, you can then take this cell and you can squash it. Now, you squash them at random, but some of the cells that you squash, relative to the squash, are going to be sitting like this. So if I squash the cell this way, and then I look from the top, all the chromosomes are going to be spread out in a plane. So you just squash a lot of cells, and some of them happen to be oriented in the right plane, and you take a photograph, and you can see all their chromosomes. And that's called a squash, and there's some sample squashes shown on your handout. There it is. I need my special eraser. So let's look at some typical squashes and see what you can do with them. So we actually have here three cell squashes. Tell from looking at a squash. first of all, you can just tell how many chromosomes there are. And we've rigged this example, so of course there are four chromosomes each time. But you notice when you look more carefully, they're quite different. In the first case, all four are different. In the second case, all four are the same. And in the third case, two are one size, a shape, and two are another. So how do you tell these apart? One of the things you do is you make what's called a karyotype. And that's what's shown on the bottom. So this picture is a squash. What is a karyotype? For a karyotype, you take all of the chromosomes, and either using computers or paper and scissors and tape, you take this picture and cut out each chromosome, and then you line them up from largest to smallest. So for the first cell, it would be something like this. The second one, something. These are shown on the bottom of that panel. Now, for cells that only have a few chromosomes, you don't really need to bother with a karyotype. You can tell what you want to tell from a squash. But for human cells that have 46 chromosomes, looking at a squash isn't very helpful. It's very hard to keep straight what you've got when you're looking at 46 all spread out. So for any organism that has a large number of chromosomes, which is most organisms, it's much, much easier to look at a karyotype. Because then you can see much more clearly what you've really got. And by the way, in your notes, there are links to two websites which allow you to try and make your own. Not of your DNA chromosomes, but do it for yourself. So when you look at the karyotype, what do you see? Now, the first thing you notice is the number of kinds of chromosomes. You can see that that's different for each of these cases. In the first case, how many different kinds of chromosomes?
Four.
It's clearly four. What about the last case?
Two.
It's obviously two. Now, what about the middle one? Well, especially if you have the color version, it's clearly one. But if this were a real karyotype, you wouldn't really be sure, because chromosomes can be the same size and quite different. These two, for example, could have one set of kind of information, and the other two could have something else. But they're just the same size, and all you can tell here is the size and where the centromere is. Can you tell anything else? There is a technique called banding. Which allows you to tell more. You treat the fixed cell with its stuck down chromosomes. You treat this slide or preparation with certain chemicals and then certain dyes. And these dyes stick differentially to different parts of the chromosome, either because there is different packing of the DNA in different parts, some tighter, some looser, or because of differences in base sequence. Whatever the reason is, each chromosome gives you a unique banding pattern. So before we drew a chromosome, something like, let's say, this, you would see a banding pattern, and you would see the same one on the sister, and let's say something like that. Now you might have another chromosome that's exactly the same size and has its centromere in the same place, but it could have a different pattern. Now, these two are not the same type. Either same size, same centromere, but they're clearly different types. They carry different genetic information. They have things arranged differently. Now, if you did banding, you would be able to tell whether, in case number, the middle case, what you really had. And if you did banding, you would see that all four of these are the same. There's only one type. This banding business is especially important in human karyotypes because you have about five pairs of chromosomes that are about the same size and look about the same without banding. But if you band them, you can clearly tell all of them apart from each other. Okay. Now, there's a symbol used for the number of kinds, and that's capital N. So capital N is the number of kinds, which is, respectively, as we've said, 2, 1, and 4. Now, the next question is, how many of each type do you have? This is called ploidy. From haploid, diploid, triploid, etc. If you have one of each kind, the cell is said to be haploid. If you have two of each kind, the cell is said to be diploid. If you have three of each kind, the cell is said to be triploid, etc., etc. So, for example, in this cell, how many of each kind?
One.
In this cell, how many of each kind? Four. And in this cell, two. So there are four kinds, one of each, one kind, four of each, two kinds, two of each, total, two times two, or one times four, or four times one. Now, another way of symbolizing this is if you have one of everything, the cell is said to be haploid, or 1N. That is, it has N chromosomes, one of each. In this case, N is 4, but N could be something else. If you have two of everything, you're said to be diploid, or 2N. And if you have four of everything, you are tetraploid, or 4N. Now, almost all of your body cells are diploid. They have two of everything. Yes?
Are these cells in metaphase?
Yes.
Okay, so does each symbol represent two copies of the chromosome?
Like, so you mean like this?
Right. Is that...
Well, if it's in metaphase, what is this? Is this one chromosome with two chromatids or two different chromosomes?
One chromosome with two chromatids.
This is one chromosome with two chromatids, so maybe we should write it this way. How are the two halves related?
They're the same.
But they're still held together because we haven't reached the stage where one chromatid goes to one daughter cell and one chromatid goes to the other. Now, in some metaphase spreads, the two sister chromatids stick together and you see pictures like this. Or when people draw diagrams of banding, they sometimes only draw one chromatid because these two are the same. But at metaphase, all your chromosomes have two chromatids per. Now, what's with the V? You get a V when the centromere is on the end and the two sisters are connected that way. Okay. Any more questions about any of this? Yeah.
Is the centromere always going to form in the same place for a given chromosome?
For a given chromosome, the centromere always forms in the same place because you have a specific type of DNA sequence here, which leads to the formation of the centromere there. Yes?
Is it ever possible to get three?
Is it possible to get three? Yes, there are cells that are triploid. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
For humans, your body cells are all diploid. You have two of everything. However, your egg and sperm cells, your gametes, are haploid and have only one thing, have only one of everything. The original cells to be understood were called diploid. And you would think you would call this one monoploid. But it's called haploid because it has half of what the usual is. Now, there are some simple organisms that are basically haploid. But all higher organisms are diploid except for their gametes. Tetraploidy isn't all that rare. Most organisms, but the most famous example of tetraploids is Easter lilies are tetraploid. Many cultivated plants are multiploid, or polyploid as they're called. Due to some accident, they accidentally doubled their DNA content, and they tend just to be bigger and nicer looking. Doesn't work so well with animals, but it works with some, but not most animals. But Easter pulleys are tetraploid. Wheat is thought to be hexaploid, etc. Triploid cells are not that common, but there are certain cells in plants that are triploid. Okay. Okay, let me just see if I forgot anything here that I wanted to say. So what we have been talking about here is a normal karyotype. And there is one other thing you see in a normal karyotype which we have to emphasize. We've said that the two halves of a doubled chromosome, a chromosome with two chromatids, the DNA in the two chromatids is identical. It's customary to call these sister chromatids. These two. Now, there are people who think that this is sexist or inappropriate and prefer sibling chromatids, or I guess you could call twin chromatids, or whatever you want to call them. I think that women get such a little press officially that it's nice to call them sister chromatids, but it's up to you. But the point is that they're the same. But now consider your cells, which are diploid, or any cell. What is the relationship, say, between these two and these two, or between these four? In other words, what we're saying is, if you have two chromosomes, and they have the same morphology, the same shape, etc., and they have the same banding pattern, what is the relationship between these two? Now, we know that the two halves of each chromosome, the two chromatids, are identical. And we know the two, so we'll call them A and B. We know the sister chromatids of A are identical, and the sister chromatids of B are identical. But how is A related to B? I want you to stop for a minute and think, maybe discuss with the person next to you. Do you know a word for the relationship of A to B? Are they identical? Are they totally different? Do they have any relationship at all? Does anyone think of a term that they've ever heard of that works? If you can't think of a term, well, what was it? Allele. How do alleles come in? What are alleles? Alleles are different possible or alternative forms of the same gene. So we have, let's say here, an allele of some gene, say the hemoglobin beta chain gene. Where do we have an identical allele?
Right next.
Here?
No.
Here? Here? No. It has to be in the same place on the sister chromosome. So we know that, in fact, we have the same genes here. But now, what about B? Do we have the same allele here?
Not necessarily.
We could. What do we have here, though, for sure? We have the same gene. If this is the gene for the beta chain of hemoglobin, there's a copy here and a copy here. In this picture, there are four copies of that gene. Now, we know that the two copies on chromosome A are the same, and the two copies of chromosome B are the same. But the allele on B doesn't have to be the same as the allele on A. They have to be alleles of the same gene, but they don't have to be the same. One could be the beta A allele, one could be the beta S allele. If you're talking about eye color, one could be the blue determining allele, one could be brown. Okay, so they have to have, the same genes in the same order, but not necessarily the same alleles of the same gene. So if gene X is over here, where is there another copy of gene X? There has to be one here, and one here, and one here. So these two alleles of gene X have to be the same. These two have to be the same. But the ones on A don't have to be the same as the ones on B. Where did those two chromosomes come from? Suppose this is a human pair of chromosomes. In fact, we know that A came from one parent and B came from the other. You got one from your mother and one from your father. They both have the same genes in the same order, but not necessarily the same alleles of the same gene. So, what is the relationship to say if I just draw one of the A's and one of the B's? How are these two? This is a chromatid of A, or A before DNA replication. This is a chromatid of B, or B before DNA replication. How are they related to each other? What do you think? Homologous is the right term. The two chromosomes are said to be homologs or homologous. Remember we talked about crossing over in bacteria? We said for two DNAs to cross over, they have to be homologous. So the pairs of chromosomes are homologous. So in this case, we have two homologs of the X-shaped chromosome, two homologs of the V. In the middle case, we have four homologs, or four homologous chromosomes. So A and B are homologs, or A and B are said to be homologous. Now, if you were to actually look at a human karyotype, how is it different from what we've drawn up here? If we actually looked at a squash of a human, we would see 46 chromosomes. And if we lined them up and we made a karyotype, I'm just diagramming it, we would have 23 pairs. So humans are diploid, surprise. So one of these chromosome 1s you got from a mother, one from your father, one of the chromosome 2s from your mother, one from your father, etc. Now when you line them up, there are 22 pairs that are the same in morphology, that is shape and appearance and banding. And it doesn't matter which sex you got the chromosomes from, you will see the same 22 pairs. But if you got this from, the 23rd pair is different depending on whether it came from a male or a female. So if it came from a female, the 23rd pair is two large X-shaped chromosomes. And if it came from a male, there will be one X and one small chromosome. These big ones are called X's. The little one is called a Y. So a female is said to be XX, and a male is said to be XY. Now, everything we have discussed so far comes from looking at normal karyotypes. Now, you can see certain kinds of abnormalities from looking at karyotypes. People sometimes divide mutations into two major categories. Those are so big that they're major rearrangements and you can see them in a karyotype. And those that are so small that you can't see them. If you change one base or even 100 bases, you can't tell in a karyotype. You delete 100 bases, it looks the same. But if you delete thousands of bases, then you can see in a karyotype. Each of these bands is not just a few bases, not just a few genes, but probably hundreds of thousands of bases and several genes. So in a karyotype, you can see large rearrangements and missing and extra chromosomes. And I think we won't talk about that today because there's something else I would rather do. So what we're going to leave is what you see from looking at an abnormal karyotype, because next time we're going to talk about how you get them. And what I want to do now is consider just sticking to normal karyotypes. What do they imply? My karyotype and my husband's karyotype and my children's karyotype are all the same except for the sex chromosomes. Now, I have 46 chromosomes, my husband has 46 chromosomes, and my children do not have 92. So how does that work? There must be some way of picking from me not 46, but 23. And 23 for my husband, and putting them back together again, and lo and behold, you get 46. There has to be a way of taking one of these and passing that on for me, one of these, etc. And then, since I give one chromosome one, my husband gives one chromosome one, the kids have two. That has to exist, and that's called that's a different kind of division, or reduction division, and that's called meiosis. Now, we're not going to go into the steps of it. The steps of it are outlined on the handout in parallel to mitosis, and we'll go through those steps next week. But I want to consider the overview of meiosis. What is it for, and what does it achieve? Now, we've already implied that the point of meiosis is to pick one from column A, one from column B, one from column C. Why bother? It would be a lot simpler if I could take, say, one cell from here, one ordinary diploid cell, put it in a bottle and grow up a kid. Save us a whole lot of work. Save us a whole lot of fun, too, but that's another issue. Now, some plants do that. You know, you can break a leaf off and stick it in water and it will grow a whole new plant, but it does not work with people. And even plants, virtually every higher organism, engages at some time in meiosis. What is the point of having meiosis, getting haploids, and then pairing the haploids and putting them back together to make a diploid? The whole point of it seems to be to reshuffle the genetic information, to make new combinations of genes and chromosomes. This is the same rationale as with bacteria. The whole point of sex, biologically defined, is to reshuffle the genetic material. Now, it may be you need to reshuffle it in order to repair. It may be you need to reshuffle it in order to get new combinations for selection to act on. But either way, you seem to need new combinations. So how does this work? Consider just two pairs of chromosomes. Let's say I have these. My husband, so to speak, has these. Now, if we had mitosis only, an individual could get only pink chromosomes or only white chromosomes. But meiosis means we take one from each category. And then through fertilization or mating, we put them back together again. And now we're able to get new combinations of pink and white chromosomes, so to speak. Now, if we continue this for many generations, we will be able to get all possible combinations of pinks and whites. And if you think that there's actually 23 pairs instead of two, you can see that the number of permutations and combinations is enormous. So, sexual reproduction gives you new combinations of chromosomes. Now, it goes further than that. We've already said that if you have homologous DNAs, you can get crossing over, or what is usually called genetic recombination. Now, in humans, this is restricted to meiosis. At meiosis, when you are producing gametes, you can have crossing over. That is, remember, these are double-stranded DNAs. You can cut the pink DNA. You can cut the white double-stranded DNA, you can rejoin them crosswise, and end up with recombinant chromosomes. So, not only does sexual reproduction, that is meiosis followed by fusion or fertilization. Not only does it reshuffle the deck of chromosomes, but it allows you to make cards that are, so to speak, half from one deck and half from the other. It allows you to cut and rejoin chromosomes and reshuffle the genes on a single chromosome. Now, how does that work? To look at the big picture, let's look at 19C at the bottom. Now, this picture is also in your notes, although I've rearranged it slightly. Now, when you start out, let's just consider a cell with one pair of chromosomes to keep it simple. It turns out that both meiosis and mitosis start the same way. They start by the duplication of the DNA during interphase. So before we can do any cell division at all, our chromosomes have two chromatids. Now, if we wanted to do mitosis, we know what to do. Each daughter cell gets one white and one pink chromatid, and we would get two daughter cells identical to the original. But what do we want to do with meiosis? When we get finished, what is a cell supposed to have? Double white? Double pink? Single white? Single pink? Both? What's the whole point of meiosis? It's to get one or the other. So when we get all done, we want either all single white or a single pink. And if there were multiple pairs, we would want one from this pair, one from this pair, one from this pair. Well, if we're going to end up, if we've got DNA that looks like this, or chromosomes that look like this, and remember, each line is double-stranded DNA. If we're going to end up with cells that have what we want, how many products do we have to have? If we take this genetic information and we divide it up to get this cell is what? Diploid, haploid, triploid, tetraploid? This cell is diploid. We want cells that are haploid and that have single chromosomes in addition. How many copies of the genetic information? Four. How much do we want per cell? One. How many cells are we going to have? Four. So we're actually going to have to end up with this. So we're going to have to divide that four ways. And in order to do that, meiosis has two divisions instead of one. So in division one, what you do is separate the two homologs. But you're not done because each chromosome is still double, two chromatids. So then you have to do something sort of along the lines of meiosis so that each of these chromatids ends up a full chromosome and each of these. So this is second division. So you go from two single chromosomes to two doubled chromosomes to one doubled chromosome to one single chromosome per cell. Now, in terms of ploidy, of number of types, how many do you have? You only have one type of chromosome here, but you have two of them. So this cell is 2N or diploid. What is this cell? It's still diploid. What is this cell? It's haploid. And this cell is haploid. But this doesn't cover the situation, because clearly these two are different, and these two are different. So I need some other way to keep track of that. So the way you keep track of that is you call the amount of DNA, suppose I call the amount of DNA in here X. This is the minimum, right? So I put two of these together, and I get this one. I'd have 2X, and then 4X, and then 2X, and then X. Instead of X, it's customary to use C for content of DNA. So you say this cell has C DNA. Whatever C is. More chromosomes, bigger value of C. But whatever it is, this cell has the minimum amount of DNA. So this cell has how much? 2C. This one? 4C. This one? 2C. And this one? C. So by keeping track of DNA content and chromosome number, that covers the territory. Now the picture on the top, which we just want to look at very briefly, summarizes the whole thing all over again from a slightly different angle. If you look at the second column on your handout, the second column says exactly the same thing we just did, except it draws a pair of chromosomes without any cells. It's what's in one cell. So that's in the first cell. This is after DNA replication. This is after first division. And this is after second division. And now two of these fuse and you start over. Okay. So instead of, we didn't draw two cells here and four cells there, this is per cell. Now on the left, we've put in three pairs just to be sure you can keep it straight. If we had three pairs, what would happen? We'd go from three pairs to three doubled pairs. But now, what would we have here? So we'd have, let's just draw it like that. And now what would we have after first division? One from column A, one from column B, one from column C. We'd have one of each. And then after second division, we'd have one of each, but only with one chromatin. Now, this is summarized in the three columns, the four columns on the right, the number of chromosomes, chromatids per chromosome, the ploidy, or the number of each kind, the number of chromosomes, and the DNA content. So I'm not going to run through this, because you can do that yourself, but this is a summary, and you should be sure you understand how you get the table on the top. And what we'll do next time is discuss the details of meiosis. How do you actually pull off separating homologs in first division and separating sister chromatids in second division? So bring back your handout. I know it's a week from now, but hold on to it and bring it back. Now, I have office hours today twice. Let me just turn this off.